I want my country back, and the country I'm talking about would not tolerate this nonsense.
But now you have a choice. There is a party that will represent you and stand up for common sense.
And when the dam bursts, it will do so spectacularly.
I overturned the biggest ever Conservative majority of 25,500 people.
But if Britain is broken, then logically, Britain needs reform.
Hello, and a warm welcome to the latest episode of the Reform Party podcast. I'm not going to do much of an introduction today because really I don't know where this conversation is going to go. I have a few things I think we might talk about. We might talk, I think, about cancel culture, free speech, transgenderism, two-tier policing, climate change, and probably grooming gangs. But if we miss any of these, don't let me know, because as I say, the conversation I think could go anywhere. So without further ado, let me introduce today's guest, Mr. Nick Buckley, MBE. Hello, Nick.
Hello. Thank you for having me and inviting me along today.
Thank you very much for coming. Do you want to start off just by giving us a little bit about your personal background, where you were born, brought up, that sort of thing?
Sure. Basically, I'm nobody. A kid brought up on a council estate in South Manchester, single parent household, went to a failing school. My school was that bad that my music teacher was stabbed 42 times in the chest.
Good grief.
For confiscating a porno mag off one of the kids. I drifted through my teens and my 20s, waiting for someone to knock on my door and offer me some amazing opportunities, but no one knocked on my door. And then when I got to 30, I realised this isn't working out. So then I decided to do something about it. So I got a job at Manchester Airport, which led to a job at Manchester Council. I started working with kids, stopping them getting involved in crime and antisocial behaviour. Won some awards for that, got promoted. And in the end, I ran Manchester City Centre in terms of reducing crime for Manchester Council and the police. And then the austerity kicked in 2011. My job was made redundant. My team were made redundant. So I took the money on the table and used that money to set up a charity called Mancunian Way, working on the streets with kids. Again, stop them getting involved in crime and antisocial behaviour. So not pink and fluffy projects, not taking them from McDonald's, not taking them gold carting because you've been a good boy this week, but having serious conversations on the streets about what you're doing is going to get you into trouble. We can help you get a job. We can help you understand life. We can help you navigate. We'll hold the map for you, but you've got to make the decisions of where you want to go. And that work's been extremely successful. It's a multi-award winning charity now. And then I'm sort of infamous for 5 years ago, 2020, during June, at the height of the Black Lives Matter fiasco.
Ah, yes. Let's get into that, because this is, I said, one of the things we'd probably talk about is cancel culture.
Yes.
And you must have been not one of the original, but one of the fairly early on people to have been cancelled. Would that be fair?
Yeah.
So basically, you'd set up this charity. It was everything was going great, very successful.
Yep.
And you did, was it a podcast or a Substack or a blog or something, in which you criticised the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah.
And you criticised it on the basis that it was a Marxist organisation and it wasn't the kind of organisation it purported to be. Is that fair?
Yep, spot on.
And of course, as things transpired, you were proven to be absolutely correct.
Proven to be 100% correct. Everything I said 5 years ago, nobody would raise an eyebrow saying it now.
Yeah.
But 5 years ago, we all went mental because it was in the middle of COVID, all locked in our houses. A foreign criminal, career criminal dies in a foreign city, in a foreign continent, in a foreign country. And we think we it's got something to do with us. It was just a strange time.
Well, it was absolutely strange. And I mean, the two images that I have from that time, which seemed that's at the time bizarre, but now seem even more bizarre, is one, a police kneeling in front of a Black Lives Matter demonstration down in London. And also people banging their pots and pans for the NHS during COVID.
Yeah.
Those are the two images from that time that stick in my head as being, you know, utterly bizarre.
Both those images, so half my family working in the NHS, actually, you know, nurses, auxiliary staff, and none of them banged pans on their doorsteps because they all said it was pathetic and they worked in the NHS. And the police officer who took the knee to Black Lives Matter should have been sacked. Absolutely should have been sacked on the spot. But we had politicians doing it. We had celebrities do it. We had Premier League football teams doing it.
I think they're still doing it, aren't they?
They're doing it every now and again.
Oh, every now and again now.
Yeah, they've not stopped doing it. It's sort of special times of the year. We'll take the knee to a racist organisation or a Marxist.
Yeah. Yeah. And you were you also involved in the Manchester riots in 2011?
I was based in Manchester City Centre Police Station at that time.
Right.
It was 1 or 2 days before I was made redundant. So I was leaving. I remember leaving the Brutal Street Police Station with two carrier bags full of all my possessions, and the police station was empty. I had no goodbye, no one shook my hand, no one said thank you, because the station was empty because we're in the middle of the riots. That's how I remember that.
Yeah. Going back to the cancellation, basically, as I understand it, you, as I say, were CEO, and you had somebody came in to see you and expressed the view that they didn't agree with you on the Black Lives Matter issue. And then they took that to the Board of Trustees, is that?
No, it all happened online.
Oh, did it?
So I wrote an article, put it online, and then some people disagreed with it. Someone took the link and put it on Twitter. Then it went mental.
Mm-hmm.
6 months before, I'd just been awarded an MBE from our late Queen. So in 6 months, I went from MBE to a Nazi. So online people were calling me a Nazi, a racist, a this, a that. Somebody set up a petition to have me fired. That got 450 signatures. The board of the charity, again, which I set up, I appointed the board, and they panicked. Turned out, you know, they were friends of mine, they were cowards, and they sacked me over email.
And these were people who you'd probably known for quite a long time.
And you wanted them for 15 years.
Mm. It's interesting. I had a not as bad an experience, but a similar experience in business, whereby it's a long story, but basically a guy who I'd worked with for 30 years and spent a lot of time with, even right up to the end, spending more time with him than I was spending with my wife, sort of thing. And basically, in order to get rid of me and promote himself, it's a complicated story, but he absolutely stuck the knife in, and I was never. I was a bit the same. I had to leave the business, which I was at by that time managing director of. I had to walk out and not speak to any of the staff on the way out, and you know, and people that had, as I say, had been there for 30 years. It was very, very hurtful.
It is, and that's a worse case than mine, but I understand what he did and why he did it. It was all about gaining something for himself. My board gained nothing. They were, you know, to sit on a board of a charity, it's a voluntary position, so you don't get paid. They knew me personally. It was just pure cowardice.
So was it just the media frenzy that persuaded them to do this?
Purely, they saw what was going on online and thought to themselves, I'm presuming, they've never spoken to me. And they probably presume, look what's going online. If we don't give him Nick's head, they may come for our head. I would rather give him Nick's head than my head. And that was a conclusion they came up with.
Yeah. And this online persecution seems to be a feature of a lot of the cancellations, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Are you involved with Toby Young at all?
It was Toby Young's Free Speech Union that saved me.
Oh.
So I reached out to Toby Young. He phoned me up and I said, this is what's happening to me. I've just been sacked.
Because this is going back to what, 2021, is that right?
2020.
And Free Speech Union was up and running then? I thought it was more recent than that.
It started in the February. I contacted them in June.
Right, okay.
So
it was right at the beginning of it.
It was as if they set up just to help me.
You.
I was their first big win.
Right.
I was their first big win. So they got solicitors involved. We looked at my contract. The solicitor, this is quite funny, solicitor looked at my employment contract and said, which idiot wrote this? And I went, I wrote it to save the charity money. So I just wrote my own contract. He went, Nick, your incompetence has paid off. He went, there's no get out clause. They can't sack you. So we knew legally it was solid. Mm. So we wrote to the board, the four members of the board, and we basically said, Nick Buckley is going to sue you. He's not suing the charity. He's suing you personally, as an individual. Yeah, yeah. And he's coming for your houses. He wants your house. Unless all four of yous resign together, and in which case he'll walk away.
I'm sorry, so you didn't return to the charity at that point?
No, I'd been sacked.
It wasn't that you got back in instead of them?
That's what happened after they retired, after they were resigned.
Oh yeah, so you did go back then?
So yes, so they resigned, we appointed a new board, and the new board offered me my job back. Mm. But I still lost, because I only could stick it out for a year.
Right.
The charity at that point almost collapsed. All the funders pulled out because of what had gone on. And then a year later, I had to leave and walk away on good terms this time, because many funders still wouldn't fund the charity anymore because I was involved, and I was still a Nazi. I was still a racist. So I wasn't allowed to run the charity I founded. So I had to walk away just to save the charity.
So it wasn't a complete win then?
No. Everybody lost. Yeah. I lost. The board lost. When I came back, we had to make redundant quite a lot of staff because our finances collapsed.
And is the charity still running?
It's running now. It's stable. It's growing again. It won a national award last year. It's doing fantastic work.
Good, good. That's good to hear. You mentioned briefly funding there. This is something I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet about, is charities and the funding. I mean, it goes back decades, but when I began to realise that I was looking around to make some charitable contributions. And what I wanted to do was to find a charity that was, in my view, pure. In other words, it wasn't accepting money from government. Mm. Because the problem is that as soon as a charity starts to take money from government, whether it's in grants or whatever, they become effectively another arm of the government. They're operating on behalf of the government as a non-governmental organisation. And when you looked at all the big charities, there was none of them that you could support. Mm. The only one I found that wasn't taking government money was the RNLI. Mm. And I set up a subscription to the RNLI, which I have to say, I have now cancelled.
Good, good, good.
But, that's how difficult it was. What's your view on the relationship between government and charity?
Let me start by saying this. The charity sector is almost wholly corrupt. And I mean corrupt in the way we mean corrupt. Mm. The amount of scams, the amount of fraud, the amount of the misrepresentation of what they're doing. It's a problem that will come to the fore at some point, just like the MP's expense scandal, just like the grooming gang scandal. At some point, people will look into the charities in this country, and it all needs tearing down and starting again, because most of the things we think are charities are not charities. No. Most charities that set up are not what you think a charity is. The definition's too broad. The reason why charities do rely on government is because the government taxes too much. So if the government tax was a lot less, a bit like America, people in America are in the habit of giving to charities because it's how they fund the third sector over there. In this country, we're taxed at such a high rate. We expect the government to solve our problems because we're paying so much tax. We need to dramatically reduce how much we take off people, and that will encourage them to get involved in their communities more, run the services in their community, volunteer more, fund their local youth club, their local charities. That's the way forward.
But the result is terrible, isn't it? Because in my view, giving to charity is one of the best things that you can do. Mm. It's selfless. You're giving your resources to somebody else because you're choosing to do it. So it's good from your point of view. As far as the beneficiary is concerned, it's good from their point of view. Somebody is giving them, money or whatever it is, to them. So it's virtuous on both sides. Mm. The
way where the government comes and takes taxation at the point of a gun, effectively, and then gives it to somebody else and says, you know, that spoils the whole thing, in my view.
It does, and it also takes your decision of where you, of who you want to help.
Mm.
So at the moment, we're funding one-legged lesbians with blue hair, with Maori face tattoos, with satin wheelchairs. We're funding them. I don't want to fund them. If somebody wants to fund them, fantastic. I'm not saying they shouldn't be funded. I'm not saying they haven't got, you know, services they need. But other people can fund that if they want to fund it. I want to keep my taxes back so I can fund stuff in my community around young people, around crime and disorder, around other things that I find important. You might want to fund donkey sanctuaries because you love donkeys. I disagree with that, but if that's what you want to fund, you should be able to fund that. We need to give communities more responsibility over themselves and in control of what they spend their money on. And once we give it to a government, they waste. I've worked in government. I've seen the waste. They waste so much of it. And the money they don't waste then gets given to their pet projects. Mm. It's what they think will help them get elected. It's what their, you know, their voters want. It's what they think will make them look good. That's what the Green Agenda is all about, making them look good. We need less government and less government involvement in our lives, and especially with our money.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's terrible. I did worked as a consultant for a while for a small NGO in Merseyside. And basically, they had three people in the NGO. They had the chief executive.
Yep.
They had a woman who was applied for all the grants.
Yeah.
So she's full time. All she did was apply for whatever, for grant funding from government. They had another woman who was the PR. So she spent all the time getting this organization's name and papers and so on to promote on the grant funding. That was it, the three of them.
Mm.
And they were supposed to be working for the good of people in Merseyside. Mm. They didn't do anything for the people in Merseyside. Yeah. It was purely self-perpetuating. They only existed for themselves.
Yeah. Lots of charities are just like that. Hence why we need a better charity commission.
Mm.
The charity commission we've got at the moment is not fit for purpose. Part of that's down to funding. I would get to a stage in the UK where we need to tax charities. Let's say it's 0.5%. Let's say if your charity income is over £10,000, you get charged 0.5% on your income. If you have a multinational charity, you get charged 5% on your income. That money then gets diverted into a new charity commission who has teeth and an enforcement arm who can start checking all the charities that they're doing what they should be doing. There's no fraud. You know, there should be no tax breaks for any charity in this country who works abroad. I don't want any charities working abroad. You shouldn't even be able to register as a charity in this country if your main aim is building wells in Africa or helping, teaching girls to swim in Bangladesh. I don't care. I mean, we shouldn't be funding any of that. Like I said, the charity sector is corrupt. It's a feel-good way of middle-class people to virtue signal, and for some of them to make a bloody good living.
Well, I mean, some of the big charities in the UK, the people on the board are earning hundreds of thousands of pounds. I mean, it's...
Once a charity gets too big, it needs to split into two.
Hmm.
I tell people all the time, never give money to the charities you've heard of. Never give them money. Never give money to Oxfam, to Children in Need, to Save the Children, all these big ones you've heard of. Never give them a penny, because most your money is wasted. Most your money.
What percent? If I were to give £10 to Oxfam,
yeah,
what percentage of that £10 do you think would actually be delivered to people on at the end of the this travel?
Less than 10%.
So a pound would get through.
Less than a pound would get through. They spend something. These figures aren't correct. I'm just sort of guessing from what I can remember. Something like those big charities, they spend something like 13% of their income on advertising themselves,
promoting
to generate income.
Yeah.
The chief execs are on $250,000. Let's look at Oxfam. Oxfam have been convicted of their workers in Africa and the Caribbean raping women and children. Convicted. We're funding child rapists, at least not raping children in this country, which is shocking because everybody else seems to be doing it. But we send the Oxfam staff to the Congo and to Haiti to rape children.
Yeah, it's astonishing. Mm. And I mean, this links into the whole kind of foreign aid debate, doesn't it? Because, you know, when you look at what our foreign aid actually buys us.
Yeah, nothing.
It's terrible. And that, to be fair, at least has been exposed a lot recently. It particularly has. When Trump did this thing with USAID and so on. I think that's brought home to people what's going on.
And it's been cut over the last decade. So Cameron had that at 0.9% of our GDP. Then it was reduced to 0.7% and now it's 0.5%.
Were you amused when Starmer decided that he was going to fund the increase in our security by cutting the foreign aid budget?
I'd like to cut all foreign aid, but if we have to keep foreign aid, then you fund that. I mean,
it was a bit of a U-turn for him, though.
No, absolutely. I mean, what we're wasting money on with our foreign aid, I mean, it's billions of pounds. It's not like 10, 15 billion a year. Mm. And when you think the pensioners' heating allowance was only 1.5 billion a year, and we're spending, you know, six times that on foreigners, they've uncovered some stuff. So last year we were funding a Chinese lesbian opera group in Beijing. Why are we funding that? 10 years ago, we were funding an Ethiopian Spice Girls band in Ethiopia. We just
did you see the thing with Rory Stewart and his wife?
Yeah, she was getting $1 million from USA.
He came on and he's complaining that this million had been cut. Mm. My wife, you know, she was expecting this £1 million and now she's not getting it.
Yeah.
And then when they began to look into what the charity was and what they were doing with the money, it was astonishing.
It was her charity when the Americans were in control of Kabul. It was her charity that was getting Muslim women together, obviously in hijabs, and they were being shown.
Showing modern art.
Modern art. And one of them was a male urinal. and that's what they were funding.
Yeah, it's comical.
Yes. I mean, it's completely abused foreign aid. It all needs to go. We've got problems in this country that need fixing. We need to spend the money on that.
Mm, absolutely. Going back to free speech more generally, what would you say the state of free speech in the UK is now?
We're in a mess, but it is slowly getting better and worse. So it's getting worse because this government, just like I hate the Tory government just as much as I hate this Labour government. This isn't a Labour problem. This is a uni-party problem. But the Labour government now is passing new laws now to clamp down on free speech and free assembly and free opinion and everything. Just following on from what the Tories put in place. So that's getting worse. But what's getting better is we all know it's happening now. We all know we're being persecuted. We all know we're being silenced. And more people like you are speaking up, are creating podcasts, are determined not to be silenced. And I'm determined not to be silenced. And we will be victorious at the end of the day.
We will. I'm sure we will. Because, you know, at the end of the day, that's what should happen. But it's, even I find that I have to start and think before I put something onto Twitter because of, you know, the clampdown that there has been. Mm. I mean, you look at the you know, the sort of two-tier justice that's been meted out to people like Lucy Connolly and Peter Lynch and so on, and you begin to think, well, you know, if I write that, you know, is somebody going to knock on my door?
They may knock on your door, and it's a chance you have to take. And if you're self-censoring too much, then you're part of the problem.
I accept that, and I try and be brave.
Yeah, and that's all we can do.
But still, I still find myself self-censoring to an extent.
Well, to a certain extent, we've always done it. You don't speak to your mum the way you speak to your friends in the pub.
Mm.
You self-censor.
Mm.
We all wear different masks depending what situation we're in, depending which version of ourselves we portray. So we've always done that. We always are self-censoring. And many times I'd like to go, oh, F this and F that. And I don't do it because I self-censor, depending where I am. But you're right, because people now go to jail in this country. Not the Soviet Union, not North Korea, not banana republics in the Caribbean or Africa, not those countries, this country. People go to jail in this country now for speaking, for posting things online.
For expressing their genuine opinion.
Yes.
Yeah, it is appalling. And I don't quite know how we've got here, do you?
Very slowly, one step at a time.
Boiling a frog.
Yep. So over the last 30 years, there was many times where we should have stood up and said, no, There was many times where British and English men sort of stood up and said, no, no more, we're not having that. But we didn't. And for convenience, we took a small step backwards.
And why didn't we?
Because cowardice, convenience, to fit in, our lives were good, why fight for something? Things like feminism has told men, toxic masculinity, yeah. don't voice your opinion, don't stick, we don't need you sticking up for us. All these things chipped away, and we are where we are because of it.
Do you think there's an element that the English man, as you talked about a minute ago, is not the same English man now, somebody who's, say, 30, 35, is not the same as you and I were when we were 30, 35?
Oh, absolutely. And when we were 35, we weren't the same as the people 100 years ago from now either. No. We're turning into inferior versions of the English men who came before.
Yeah.
And I wrote a book on this. My latest book is called England's My England, available on Amazon. And
I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, thank you. And I give many reasons for this. So the first reason is feminism. It starts there. It starts 150 years ago with feminism. Feminism was nothing to do with equal rights. It had nothing to do with voting. That's what these radical Marxist women were telling us it was about. But modern feminists now even tell us got nothing to do with equal rights. That was all a scam to help us push our agenda. Then look at the two world wars. The two world wars killed 1.25 million of the best men of this country. We never recovered from that.
No.
The bravest men were more likely to die in a war because they were the ones who would run to the front, storm the machine gun nest. The weaker men would pull back a little.
The Scots were very well good at that. I mean, they used to send us in as the first wave, didn't they, to soak up all the bullets.
The elite would send anybody as machine gun fodder. Yeah. But we lost the bravest men. And then we need to look what's in... And then those men never came home to raise their children. So boys then didn't have those strong role models after the wars to teach them how to be a man. It's part genetic, it's part nurture as well. And then with feminism, we started increasing the single-parent households. So no men at home anymore now. Women married the state and started taking handouts, and men walked away from their responsibilities. And then, you know, boys didn't know what it was to be a man. And then we need to look at the water. Yeah, the pill came along in the 60s. 90% of the pill, so the female estrogen, washes out of a woman down the toilet. It then goes into our water supply. The places that then clean the water don't take pharmaceuticals out the water. They only take viruses and bacteria out. So there's estrogen in our water supply now. We now look at tin cans.
And is that, do you think that's responsible for the fallen testosterone levels?
For that, for the over-feminization of men, all these things, there's not one solution. There's not one problem. All these things contributed. We have men now who get manicures and moisturise. Makes me want to throw up. And these are manly men. These aren't, you know, we're not talking about gay men or camp men. We're talking about men who go to the gym. We're talking about men who are going out on a Friday night looking for women. They moisturise and have manicures. That's how far men are falling in the West.
And do you think education plays an element in it? I mean, I remember when I went to school, the history I was taught was of the British Empire and Scott of the Antarctic and you know, all the heroic British heroes. Now, you can argue whether all of it was true or not. That's not the point. But that's not the kind of education that people 30 to 35 now will have had. They'll have had a completely different kind of education.
Oh, absolutely. Two points to that. The first point is it's who's doing the teaching. So our education system now in this country is completely dominated by women. From primary school all the way through to university. We're taught by women. The syllabus is designed by women for the benefit of girls. Boys now can't be boys at school. Why don't you sit down, be quiet? Why can't you be more like the girls? We don't do anything for the boys. Boys want, you know, they say boys don't read. But you give boys books about aliens and monsters and shooting them and killing them and saving the world. Boys will read that. But because teachers are female, the curriculum is over-feminized. We want boys to read the things girls will like. So boys just don't read. We're killing our education system because we've overcompensated for girls in there. And both of them need to be treated equally. And then it's the curriculum itself. So,
and with Bridget Phillipson getting in, when her curriculum comes out, it's not going to get any better, is it?
No, it's going to get worse. It's been getting worse all my life. So now the histories we're taught is a Marxist agenda. It's this victim narrative that the British Empire was terrible. Everybody else's empires were fantastic. It was just a British Empire that did bad things. Transatlantic slave trade. Oh, the English. Well, the English had hardly anything to do with it. They were started by Africans, run by Africans, the same Africans who are running it today. There's more black slaves alive today than at any other point in history.
And we ended the slave trade. I mean,
it cost us a fortune.
We were still paying it off in 1950, I think I heard.
No, 2015.
2015.
Was it was December 2015. We ended up paying off the loan that we used to free every slave in the British Empire. And it cost 3,000 lives as well, because we set up the West African squadron that patrolled the seas. And that's had a high death toll because of tropical diseases. Mm. Over 3,000 sailors died stopping slave ships leaving Africa. Mm. We were stopping American ships, French ships, all the ships until they came on board as well. We were amazing. We stopped the international slave trade.
And now they want us to pay more reparations.
If reparations need to be paid, then the people who should pay reparations are the descendants of the African kings and emperors who ruled Africa during that time. It was black Africans who captured black Africans and sold them into slavery. White people never caught any Africans. We never left the ships. Mm. We sailed our ships into the port and we bought African slaves off black Africans. That's what we did. I'm not saying that was right. That's a stain on our history, ever engaging in the slave trade. But it was only the British who said, this needs to stop. No one had ever said that before in the history of mankind. Nobody had ever said we need to stop slavery.
So that was effectively an expression of our values, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
British Judeo-Christian values.
Yeah. Yep. And then we enforced it on the rest of the world.
You're not supposed to enforce things. Yeah, going back to the policing, the two-tier policing we were talking about, how bad do you think that is now?
It's that bad that I actually say now I'm not a supporter of the British police. That's how bad it's become. And I'm a person who spent decades working with the police, based in police stations, training police officers, writing patrol plans, writing award-winning police projects. If someone like me now turns around and says, I do not support the British police anymore, that's how far they've fallen.
Mm. We've had David Burgess-Joyce in here, who's an ex-policeman, high-up policeman.
Yep.
And we discussed it with him. And I said to him, how far does the change in the police go back? Was it the McPherson report? We went into it in a fair bit of detail. But the conclusion we came to that it was that the police had been completely emasculated, that the Marxist ideology, which was the thing was based on, was in, and it was done from the top, really. Mm. We know that these people in the chief, ACPO and so on are infected with it. But how far down do you think it goes? If I were to bump into a Manchester policeman in the pub and have a private chat with him with no bar staff around to overhear or whatever, would I be likely to find that they believed in the Marxist ideology, or would I be likely to find that they were basically unable to do the job they wanted to do?
The vast majority of PCs don't believe in any of it.
Right.
You only get promoted in the police if you believe in this crap.
And so, again, it's a little bit like we're talking about. You can't afford to say anything.
Yeah.
So it's a freedom of speech issue as much as anything else.
If you want to be promoted in the police, if you want to rise above sergeant, so sergeants are quite down to earth as well. But once you get to inspector, an inspector is basically now a political position.
Mm-hmm.
So to get to that position, you've got to show that you believe in all the woke nonsense. And at the promotion hearings, when they're asking you questions, you've got to come up with a scenario of a project. You may never implement the project, but you've got to come up with a project. It's always based on woke. So when you're being interviewed to be an inspector, and they say, can you think of a project that will enhance the reputation of the police or will look after a marginalised community? And if you can come up with a project about one-legged lesbians who are Somalians, who this, who that, that
gets you through.
That'll get you promoted.
And that's how Serena Kennedy got to be Chief Constable of Merseyside.
Absolutely. But then there's another thing running alongside as well. And again, I have no time for feminism. I wrote a book on feminism as well a couple of years ago. Feminism is evil. Feminism is destroying most of our country. Again, it's got nothing to do with equality and nothing to do with voting rights. But we started lowering the standards in the police to allow more women to join.
Mm.
So we had to reduce the physical standards. Well, all those things had to go to let more women join. And then we started getting more women into the police. So we had to make the police more pink and fluffy so women would be accepted. So the toughness went because of that. Then we got to the 70s and 80s where we wanted more ethnic minorities to join the police. So what did we have to do? We had to reduce recruitment standards again to get more ethnic people to join. And that's not because they can't join on their own merit, but that's because ethnic minorities would make good police officers, also make good dentists. And those ethnic minority parents are saying to them, I want you to be a solicitor, a dentist, a doctor. So they're being pushed into those careers. So to get the ethnic minorities to join the police who are not good enough, we've got to reduce the standards.
Mm.
So we keep reducing the standards and standards and standards. At the same time, this victimhood mentality takes over, and now we have a failing police force.
And you see comical things on X, don't you? You know, videos of police, you know, unable to catch a woman, or deal with fairly basic policing situations.
We have police officers in this country now who can't speak English. Not because of their accent, but because they weren't born here, they've been in the country a couple of years, but they get hired as a police officer because it ticks a box.
Mm.
And you listen to them, you know, I see the videos and I think, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, you've got a Nigerian accent, a thick Nigerian accent, you don't understand the local meanings. What sort of police officer do you mean? There was a Polish police officer, English police officer, but she's from Poland, who was telling a woman outside the church, you're not allowed to sing hymns outside your church. Sing hymns inside you. It's like, how did these people get the job? They got the job because they tick boxes. We've got another woman and she's Polish and she's probably a lesbian and she's probably got ADHD. Yeah, we've ticked four boxes now. And it's really hard to sack these people.
Yeah,
I knew a PCSO when I worked with the police in East Manchester. He was convicted of domestic violence. Didn't sack him. He was then caught and convicted of drunk driving. Didn't sack him. He was found asleep in the police station when he was on shift. Didn't sack him. They finally sacked him for faking his overtime. He was putting in extra overtime saying he was doing translation services for a different police station. And he did none of it. And they finally sacked him. And when I saw his inspector, I said to the inspector, why did it take so long to sack him? We all knew he was crap. We all knew he was corrupt. No one wanted to work with him. He'd been convicted three times now of crime. He didn't sack him. He went, Nick, can't sack a black police officer. I can't sack him.
We write my own death sentence.
Yeah. And that's Greater Manchester Police.
Okay, let's just explore a little bit more about on the political side, because I was interested to see, doing my research, that you actually stood for Reform UK back in 2021 as for Mayor of Manchester.
Yep.
So you were you a member of Reform UK at that time?
There was no membership to join.
Right, okay. So you just stood on behalf of...
Yes.
And I think I noticed you got about 3%, I think.
Something like that.
And then you stood a couple of years later as an independent and you got 8%.
Yep.
I don't know what that says about Reform UK.
I beat Reform UK.
That's what I'm saying.
So I didn't stand for Reform again because at that point I still didn't know what they were about.
Mm.
And
you'd only got 3% standing for them previously.
Yeah. I want to stand again as an independent.
Right.
Because I'm sick of party politics. Mm. So I stood again last year. I beat Reform, the Lib Dems and the Greens.
Mm.
As a one-man band
yeah.
with no money.
Mm.
working just me, no volunteers, just me working on it full time for 15 months, and I did quite well.
You did very well.
Yeah, thank you. I would have come second, but Reform UK entered the race at the last minute. So all the Reform votes would have come to me.
Mm.
I was in discussions with Reform about, they said they weren't standing. So I was in discussions with Reform about, can you endorse me as an independent?
Yeah.
And then last minute, the Tory candidate for mayor defected to Reform.
That's Dan.
Yeah, I know. I can't believe I forgot his surname.
I've forgotten his surname too.
Yeah, but yeah.
Dan Walker? No. Anyway.
So he defected.
And took him on.
They took him on, and it was great PR. So I understand why they did it, but that pushed me from second to third. I would have been a Tories. Andy Burnham was unbeatable.
Right. Yeah. And probably still is.
Yes. Yeah.
And what do you think of him?
Works of space.
Mm.
But he's a competent professional politician. Mm. Keeps away from the lunatic stuff. He'll believe whatever he thinks will get him votes. His policies have not improved Greater Manchester one iota. He's been in power now 8 years.
Yeah.
He's what you would call a professional politician. But
quite a good one. I mean, they still talk about him as potentially a replacement for Starmer at some point down the line.
Yes, but that's not because he's good. That's because the Labour front bench are absolutely terrible. Everybody looks good when you're comparing yourself to lunatics.
Mm. Yeah. So you, what's your relationship with Reform now?
I joined Reform after Christmas.
Oh, did you?
Yes. So I decided at Christmas, I was deciding, am I going to stand again? Any election, and I thought to myself, well, I'm not standing again as independent because I'm not going to win as an independent.
No, you can't.
I've made my point of standing as independent. I did well, but if I'm going to stand again, I'll stand for a party. Who am I going to stand for? And there's only one game in town at the moment, which is Reform UK. Are they perfect? No, they're not. Have they made mistakes? Yes, they have. But that's to be expected because it's run by humans and all humans make mistakes. And no political party is perfect unless it's a one-man band political party and then you make all the policies yourself. So I've joined Reform. I've joined the local branch of Warrington. I'm living in Warrington now. So I've joined the local branch there. I'm supporting them. I've put my vetting in to stands
for council.
I'm definitely looking at MP.
Are you? Right.
Between now and the election, I might stand for council as well. I've put my vetting in. I'm waiting for that to be approved, and then we'll take
it. What chance do you think that will be approved?
I'm quite.
That's a joke. Man.
Well, you'd be surprised. Yeah, I'm not sure if I will be approved.
Mm.
I have serious conversations on serious topics. For me, it's a test for Reform.
I agree. And I have heard some people saying that the current regime, I mean, I think what happened was I stood at the last general election and the media frenzy was awful. Mm. I mean, I literally had, you know, people chasing me all the time, trying to analyse everything I'd ever done to try and find something they could put in the paper and pin on me, and it was awful. And I think the hierarchy got a bit were shocked by that. I think they got a bit overzealous in terms of going the other way. There were a few candidates who were disposed of in the run up to the general election, and there have been others since who have kind of fallen by the wayside. Mm. And my worry is that the vetting that they're going to do will be too extreme.
Yeah.
And everybody who's ever said anything derogatory about anybody on Twitter will be deselected. Now, if that's the case, that's going to be difficult.
It's going to be difficult, and it's... I don't know until I've had the result of the vetting.
No.
But if someone like me isn't welcome to stand for Reform UK, then there's something wrong with the vetting or there's something wrong with Reform UK. It's either one or the other. Maybe I'll fly through. Who knows at this moment in time? Well, the only thing with me is everything I've ever done said is already out there. So it's not like you have to go digging.
No.
You know, everything I've done that may be classed as controversial is already out there.
All the skeletons are in full view.
Exactly.
No, I think that's right. But I do, it's something that does worry me because we've got, in the world, I think we've got
we're going to have 66 councillor candidates at the next local elections. So we're in the process of selecting them at the minute, and we're conducting local interviews whereby we had Les Spencer on here last couple of weeks back. We're conducting local interviews while we're getting to know the people and getting to make sure that we're comfortable with them. But my worry is that we put all these forward to head office and say, these are our proposed councillor candidates, and head office come back to just knock them off. And I understand that in some cases the people have been knocked off the list without even being told why, which is not acceptable.
Well, that's not acceptable to be told. I mean, that sounds like maybe Soviet Union.
Yeah, it's Kafkaesque, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Reform. I understand what Reform are doing. Reform are worried about the uniparty attack on them, and so they should be worried because they're a threat to both parties.
Correct.
And both parties would like to see Reform gone.
The gloves are off.
Exactly. So I fully understand that. Reform have to be careful of who they're selecting. I get that. But there's a middle road.
Mm.
You cannot allow your opposition to influence who you pick to stand. A bad egg will always get through every now and again. One, you know, one in every 10,000, you know, something will always happen. We take that on the chin because all parties get that.
Yes. I mean, you look at some of the other parties and they've, half of them are like that.
Exactly. But there's no point having a Reform party if all the candidates who are standing for Reform are approved by Labour and the Tories.
Mm.
The people out there now, they want something different. They don't want a better version of the Labour Party, of the Tory
Party. It's not so much Labour and the Tories that approve them, though. I mean, it's this toxic media that we've got. That you know, that's what it's the toxic media that would go after the individuals and destroy them.
Yep.
And so that's who you that's who you're up against.
Yeah, but a lot of that is controlled by the tops of the Labour Party, the Tory Party. They want it to be two horse race.
Mm.
They've had it for 100 years, it's been quite comfortable for them. You're in power 5 years, we're in power 5 years, you're in power for 10 years, we'll be in power 5 years, then we'll have power. It's a game between them. This outsider now is danger to this two-party system. But Reform sometimes just have to be brave and we'll just have to say, no, this is our candidate.
And in fairness, they did do that to an extent. I mean, they did take some people that it wasn't all one way, is what I'm saying.
I'm sure it's a very difficult decision to make on people.
I think one thing that slightly concerns me is that I think they're outsourcing the vetting to an extent, to an a proper vetting company. Now, that's dangerous in that if you don't set the parameters of who you're looking for correctly, you'll eliminate most people, which, you know, would not be good.
Yeah. I mean, of course, if you've got somebody who is an out-and-out racist online, well, that's an automatic disqualifier. But the next question is, who defines what racist is?
Well, I was just going to come on to that because I was going to ask you, the Rupert Lowe debacle we had a few weeks back, what's your position on that?
I don't know anything that's not already in the paper. My opinion, that is, it was handled extremely poorly. If things like that are going to happen, if people fall out, which is bound to happen, you know, it's human nature, if there's disagreements, again, which will happen, should all happen behind closed doors. This should have been all dealt with internally. This reporting things online and to the press and to the police. This,
In fairness, it was Lowe that started it, wasn't it? Because he went public again, with an interview that
I've no idea who started it. I have no idea why, what's up, but it all should have been done behind closed doors.
I agree with that. Yeah. All I was saying that in the defence, that it was when Rupert Lowe published an article in the Daily Mail, I think it was, saying that he didn't think Nigel Farage was a messianic leader and he couldn't follow him and so on. It's not something that you could ignore. You can't just say, oh, one of our five MPs said this about the leader. You know, you can't ignore that.
I have no idea if it should have been ignored or not. I just know that it was handled from both sides extremely poorly. It's not damaged Reform in the country.
No, it hasn't.
But it's damaged morale in the party.
To an extent. But what it has, I think, highlighted is a division in the party. And there's always going to, I mean, all parties are coalitions to an extent. And Reform is no different. But Reform is a little bit different in that we have a coalition of different kinds of nationalists.
Mm.
We have what I like to call the ethno-nationalists. In other words, the people who look at the complexion of our country and say, I want our country to look like it used to look 30 years ago. people. So therefore, I need to remove all the people with brown skin from the country and get them back to their own countries. Mm. And that's what I want. So that's the one kind of nationalist we have. And the other kind is the more middle of the road, Farage type nationalist. So it has that it did expose that division, I think, to an extent, because you know, Lowe got a lot of support.
No, absolutely, and these discussions need to be had. And you're right; all political parties have a coalition, and we'll see what I think. What reform really need to do and really need to concentrate on is the democratisation of the party.
Yes,
that is always coming up. So until that happens, the party will always be accused.
But Nick, the party's been going 3 to 4 years.
It's going to take.
It takes time.
It's going to take time.
The Labour Party took 50 years to get the rules and procedures correct. So it's not going to happen overnight. Now, I mean, I understand completely why Nigel set the party up in the way that he did. I mean, he'd had experience of UKIP tearing itself limb from limb with all the infighting and entryism and everything else. And he realised, I can't have that happen again. So he set the party up with, he had pretty much total control over it. And that was the right thing to do. Because an embryonic party like we were, once you start to have infighting, right from the beginning, you're going to go nowhere. So he's at the point now where he's pivoting from that kind of party. Now, I mean, I'm involved quite heavily in the local branch of the party, and already we're seeing the fault lines beginning to develop. So who would we select as our council candidates? Who, if we send one, put one forward, who can head office just overrule it? So there's all sorts of things like that whereby people's views need to be fed into the mixer and then fed up through the chain. But that you have to have a structure to be able to do that. And I think we're setting it up. I think Zia Yusuf is in the process of doing that, and I think he'll do it successfully. But we're not there yet.
We're not there yet. I think we need to announce a timescale of this. This is what we're hoping will happen over the timescale. It's something that's been raised with me all the time. And I'm sure they're dealing with it, but it needs to be dealt with.
We still need this balance, don't we, between the danger of entryism and so keeping some kind of central control. Because if we just opened it up, it happened in the Labour Party a few years back when you had the reduced the joining fee to £5 and you had a whole load of socialist worker people and so on who joined and tried to change the complexion of the party.
There are solutions to all problems. So the solutions are out there. I'm not a political animal, so I can't give the answers to these things. I've not been involved in a political party before, so I'm not sure what the answers are, but the answers will exist. All that I know is we can't have a political party in this country running for top office that isn't democratic. That is just an oxymoron in itself. What democracy looks like in the party, I don't know.
Well, you'll find there'll be 20 different views on what it should look like.
Exactly.
But it will only happen through a process. Mm. I mean, it was only less than a year ago when they announced the constitution. Now, the constitution is, in my view, quite flawed, as you would expect it to be, almost being the first party constitution. But when I saw it, the question I asked was, is it changeable? Can we amend it? And the answer I got was, yes, we can, and it will be amended. And that's what needs to happen. It needs to be amended over time until you get to the version that people want.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And things take time, and I get that. And dealing with the Electoral Commission and changing things will all take time. And, we need solicitors involved, and they all cost a fortune, and they don't do anything fast. So I understand we're going to be on a several-year journey for this.
Yeah.
But as long as...
It's got to be done for 2029, hasn't it?
It has been done before the election.
Yeah.
And the party always keeps having to tell its members, this is happening, needs to keep us all informed. This is happening. We're hoping by this time next year, these things will be done. Rather than people thinking, nothing's ever been done. They're told they're doing, but not doing anything. I'm sure things are being done behind the scenes, but people need to be told.
It needs to be seen, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree with you. Going back a little bit, what... do you make about? I saw you had a bit of a run-in with was it Mermaids?
Several years ago, I would have done.
What you said earlier on, you
you dislike feminists. When I was down at Runcorn last week, I had a feminist, a girl who was ex-Labour and had joined Reform, but had been on the council with the Labour candidates, Karen Shore. And I asked her if she knew Karen Shore, and, you know, just trying to get a bit of a... And she told me the story. She's a transgender activist, and she told me the story whereby they have a tea room, a rainbow tea room in Chester, where they have a policeman dedicated to that tea room, and his only purpose is to get to dig out incidents of hate crime.
Yeah, it's a reporting centre for hate crime. Mm. Yeah.
That's astonishing to me. I didn't believe that.
There's hundreds of them, if not thousands of them, across the country. I know half a dozen in Manchester.
So these are places which are set up to encourage people to come forward and register hate crimes.
Yes.
That's appalling.
Yep. Some libraries you can do it, some LGBT centres, some community centres, some housing offices. You can go in there, not speak to a police officer, but one of their staff. Sometimes your police officer, but it doesn't have, you can report it to someone who's not a police officer. They fill the form in for you. That gets registered then with the police as a hate crime.
That's a point.
Yeah.
And she was saying, she was coming at it very much from the point of view of a gender critical feminist who disliked the trans lobby, if you like.
Yeah.
How do you think this transgender lobby has come about? Because I must say, I maybe lived in a very isolated world without much knowledge of what was going on. But transgenderism was never a thing. I didn't know anything about it until we started to hear about the ruckus that's been created.
Transgenderism only really came about after 2014. What happened in 2014? Gay marriage was legalised in the UK. So suddenly we had all these charities, all these LGBT charities who'd been fighting and making... Fighting for gay rights and making an extremely good living and got gold-plated pensions. All suddenly went, oh, there's nothing else to fight anymore now. We're going to have to close down the charity. I'm going to have to give my job up. And all the social justice warriors were going, oh, nothing to fight for anymore. Wait a minute.
Can we create another group?
Yeah, last year I met this mentally ill man. We thought he was a woman. Why don't we add that on to the LGB bit and we'll put a T on it and we can carry on the fight? And that's what everybody did. So trans people existed before that. We called them transvestites. But then suddenly they became useful to keep this money-making scam going. So that's hence why we got the trans issue then. I start off by saying there's no such thing as gender. Gender does not exist, and stop using the word gender because you're just playing into their playbook here. The sex, biological sex, and their sex-based roles. That's all that exists. Gender doesn't exist. Gender just means personality. So when people say to you, there's an indefinite number of genders, the 72 genders, what they mean is personalities. So I'm a man, I'm a woman, I may be gay, I may be not, but I'm a little bit this, I'm a little bit that, and I like a bit of pink, and I like a bit of fluffy. So I call myself a Balearian sexual now. Just made that up. I'm a Balearian sexual.
And I'm going to cut that bit out.
Yeah. Nick Buckley admits he's a Balearian
sexual. Yeah.
And it's a way of uninteresting people trying to pretend they're interesting. So don't use the word gender, use the word sex. And then because we were going through the woke stuff, everybody jumped onto it. And to a certain extent, there's two types of people who are transgender. You've got teenage girls who cannot stand being a girl. Their body's changing, they're developing breasts, their emotions are going through the roof. 20 years ago, those girls would have been cutting themselves or starving themselves or killing themselves like teenage girls do sometimes. But suddenly, oh, well, if I don't feel like I'm a girl, I don't like being a girl, I'll be a boy. So that's one type of transgender, the girls. They need mental health support. They need parental support. They need to be told and educated that this is part of your development. Your body's changing. Some people have told me that some girls, you know, they get 13, 14, 15. Suddenly, men are looking at them. So, you know, we know it's paedophilia, but men are going, you're turning into a young woman here. I can see your breath. And suddenly this girl who looked like a girl is now turning into a young woman and is getting the attention of a young woman and don't like it. Mm. It can be quite fearful when you've got perverted men looking at you in a sexual way. That's why we need fathers at home, because fathers are there to protect their daughters, yeah, to make sure they are safe. And many are families now are single parent households. So a girl now is subconsciously going, I need to protect myself because I can feel I'm being looked at all the time. And it's because I'm a girl, I might get raped, but I won't get raped if I'm a boy. So suddenly they think they want to be a boy. That's the issue there. And then when we've got trans women who are usually adult, middle-aged, perverted men who want to dress like a woman, put high heels up, call me Sheila, and I can masturbate. Well, we've always had perverted men, and society needs to deal with them with social norms. And I'm not suggesting violence to keep them in order, but we need to be less tolerant and less compassionate. And we need to say, Michael, take off the dress, wipe that lipstick off, or you're not coming in our club. You know, we don't want you playing golf dressed like that because you look mental. Now, do as you're told on, join another club. Men need to hold those men accountable, and we need to say, your name's not Sheila. Take those false breasts off. And society needs to deal with that. But again, feminists told everybody, there's no men and women are just the same. Women can do all the jobs men can do. We need to get rid of all the male-only spaces, the cricket clubs, the golf clubs, the men's clubs. We need to get rid of them all. And then some perverted men went, well, that means I can go into your spaces now, doesn't it? It means my name's Sheila and I can go in your dressing rooms. And many of the feminists went, yeah, that's what it does mean. Come on in, gents, come on in. And some of the feminists, the radical so-called TERFs, they went, oh, no, we don't like that. We hate men. And just because you dress like a woman, you stole a man, which means we hate you.
Well, I mean, in fairness to Mandy, who I was interviewed last week, you'd probably describe her as a TERF, and that she's a gender critical feminist who doesn't like.
There's a difference.
Doesn't like women.
There's
men
a difference between being
spaces.
Gender critical and being a TERF. A TERF stands for trans exclusionary radical feminist. So, the fact you're a feminist means you hate men, basically. If you're gender critical, I'm gender critical. Many women are gender critical. That doesn't mean they hate men. Mm. They're just gender critical. So we have to define the two groups.
Yeah, I think from Mandy's point of view, all she was complaining about was the fact that men could go into women's spaces. And, you know, she's right.
Does she complain that women go into men's spaces?
I don't know. I didn't ask her.
But the answer probably, no, she's not. So my point is, feminists created this problem.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. I see where you're coming from, yeah, in terms of the club one's quite powerful. I'm a golfer, and the RNA will not take the Open Championship to any club which is male only.
There we go. The Boy Scouts are now called the Scouts. Boys can't get together and do boy things with just boys and bond and learn how to be in men. Why? Because girls infiltrated the Boy Scouts. So feminists destroyed everything. And suddenly, when the tables are turned and pervert, I'm not saying men should be going to women's changing rooms and bathrooms. No, they shouldn't. But when perverted men decided to use their logic against them, suddenly some women are going, oh, this is unfair. It's been unfair for 50 years.
But in fairness, the woke lobby tried to kind of institutionalize the transgender issues, didn't they? And make them part of the structures of society. Mm. And is it not encouraging that they've actually, in my view, seem to have failed? I mean, I remember the famous interview with Nicola Sturgeon where the guy asked her about the rapist going into a women's prison and so on. And she, at the end of the day, she more or less had to admit, my ideology doesn't work.
It's also a job over it.
It doesn't fit with reality.
Yeah. Everything gets pushed too far. So all this woke nonsense really started with the abolition of slavery. That's where this really started. And you might think, oh, well, that's perfectly acceptable. And then women said, well, we want the right to vote. But while they were arguing for the right to vote, most men in this country couldn't vote either. So we started pushing and pushing. Then we got gay rights. And then we got legislation around equality. And we keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And eventually, we were going to get to a stage where everybody goes, now, that's just plain mental. And the trans issue was the bit that made us all go.
It was.
This
it was the last straw.
Mental. And mainly because it started damaging children. Mm. We've got children.
And that's right. And that's the key bit of it. So I think the bit I saw with mermaids, but mermaids were taping up girls' breasts.
Yes.
And, you know, and that's child abuse.
The woman who started Mermaids, a mentally ill woman, took her mentally ill son to Thailand to be castrated. That's the woman who set up Mermaids.
Yeah.
And then Costa Coffee, I think it was Costa Coffee or Starbucks, one of them, then collected money for Mermaids. So all the big businesses were involved in this because they all
The thing with the Tavistock Clinic and so on, I think it's been found out, hasn't it?
Yes.
It's not going anywhere now.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah. It's still happening undercover. It's not completely ended with the Tavistock Centre. It's still more work needs to be done, but you're right.
What about the things like the what's going on in education with kids? Because that worries me greatly. I've got a granddaughter who will in a few years' time be going to school. And the thought of her having the, what's it they call it, drag story time or whatever. Mm. And these are people from, it was mainly from Stonewall, I think, who were actually, these are not people from the school. These are people who are going into schools, as being paid to go into schools and expose our children to this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, the thread for this goes way back, right through in Marxism, right, you know, going right back, that the original Marxists said that the first thing you have to do if you want to make progress is to split up the family unit, to split the child from the father. And that's it's still basically the same thing.
Well, that's been happening since the 60s. You know, single-parent households started increasing. Why? Because we started paying women to throw men out of the household. You get more money. You don't need a man anymore. You then got other benefits. Society started looking up upon single mothers as if they were superheroes instead of looking upon them as, oh, you're not doing well for your child here, are you? The fact you've not got your father, your children living in your house means, in my opinion, you're slightly less of a good mother than you would have been. And a lot of people don't want to hear that. And then we started normalizing homosexuality. Again, which breaks up the family, which does those things. And we've got people now where we know he or she's a homosexual. Why do we know? They tell us. Why do we need to know in the first place? Be a homosexual. It's always gone on. But you don't need to introduce yourself as, hi, my name's Nick, I'm homosexual.
You certainly don't need to compel me to celebrate it.
Exactly. And you don't, you know, the kids in school don't need to know you're a homosexual. And then transgender came on after that. This has been a push since the Second World War to damage the family structure, and it's working. And when you damage the family structure, you end up with the society we've got now. Mm. Crime out of control, no real men protecting society, everybody living on the state, high taxes, everyone dependent upon the state to live. And it's no way I want to live.
Right, we've covered a lot of ground there, Nick.
We have.
And it's been very, very
and most
enjoyable.
Of that's going to get me cancelled.
Well, just I'll come to that in a sec. Just one final one. What about climate change? What's your views on that?
Huge con. Absolutely huge con. Is there such thing as climate change? Of course there is. Climate's changing all the time. History and paleontology and the Earth's, the way, you know, the structure of the Earth tells us that the climate's always changing and it will always continue to change. So I'm not a climate change denier. Climate's always changing. I just don't think there's anything called man-made climate change. We look at the cycles of the planets. They go through hot cycles, cold cycles. We're coming out of a cold cycle at the moment, over hundreds of thousands
that's right.
of years.
The Thames was freezing over by 1400.
Yeah. If you think this little insect on this huge planet called mankind can influence the environment and influence the climate of this planet, then you don't understand anything.
But it's been a great thing to be used by the politicians to levy extra taxes from us, isn't it?
Extra taxes, extra control, extra virtue signaling. Throughout our history, we've always had people who have said the end of the world is nigh. They used to walk around with sandwich boards on. You know, we've had people like Joan of Arc. You know, there's always been people have come along to prophesize doom and who want to be the savior. Greta Thunberg was great. She was the child messiah who was retarded and came along and said, "I'm here to save the planet." And we all bought into it because how can you not trust an 11-year-old girl with autism?
Well, it's like, you know, we said earlier that transgenderism had been found out and that it's not really as much of a threat anymore. I get the impression that we're not quite there with climate change yet, but I think we're starting to get there. Would you agree?
We're definitely getting there because of the cost. That's what's going to bring down the green agenda is the cost. I remember 30 years ago, children coming home from school telling mummy and daddy, "Oh, mummy, if you leave the light on and you do this, it's going to melt the North Pole and you're going to kill a polar bear." So we're inducting children over decades on this.
Yeah.
What's going to stop this now, the green agenda, is the cost.
Yeah.
We can't afford it.
No.
And now that places like America are rejecting it, how are we going to compete against America when they've rejected it?
Well, their energy is at a quarter of the price of ours.
Already. Mm. And that's today.
Yeah.
Once they start drilling
it worse.
We're making it worse. China ignores it. India ignores it. It's only the Western stupid countries who follow rules are trying to do something about it. It's not worth looking at. It's not worth worrying about. And it's not worth spending our tax money on it. There's nothing we can do.
Great. Well, once again, I concur with everything you've said. So I hope very much that your candidature gets through the vetting process for Reform UK. I certainly hope that this podcast won't have done anything to stop it, because if it has, because in my view, everything you've said has been spot on. So if Reform UK are the sort of party you're going to vet people out because of the sorts of things you've been saying today, then I wouldn't want to be part of it either.
I'm sure all of that will. I'm sure everything will be okay.
I'm sure it too.
Sure it'll be okay.
And just, you know, just again, finally on Reform, how do you think we're going to be doing electorally over the next year or two?
I think we'll have a cracking local elections.
Yep.
I think the Tories have not recovered, and there's no sign of the Tories recovering yet. They may start to recover before the general election, depending. Cammy Badenoch was always going to be a temporary leader.
Yeah.
It's who replaces her.
Have they got anybody?
No. No. But we will see. Labour have killed themselves with this government. It was easy being in opposition because there's always someone to point to and blame. And everything you say you're going to do sounds good, but they failed at everything.
When I lost the election to the Labour candidate, I turned around to him and said, "Be careful what you wish for."
Yeah.
Because, you know, power, taking over power at this time doesn't seem to me to be a very good idea.
Well, Labour normally come into power when we've got a really good economy.
That's right.
They've come into power for the first time where we're bankrupt and in debt. There's nothing they can do. They're not used to
it. No, they can make us more bankrupt.
Well, and they're going to do that. Next year will be good when we look at the Welsh Assembly and Scottish Parliament.
We seem to
Parliament.
Be very strong down in Wales.
Yes, I had a podcast today with a gentleman called Richard Taylor
from
Wales. We were talking about Reform and the Labour Party in Wales. He sees Labour doing really badly next year. Plaid Cymru and Reform doing really well. That's his prediction. So,
and in Scotland too. I mean, I have a few contacts in Scotland, and I think we're running about 20% up there at the minute.
Yeah. So if we can get the next year with both those elections, this May and next May, doing well, then I think that means Reform could be here to stay.
My view is that the thing is like that. The only thing that can stop us, I think, is what we talked about earlier, and that's making mistakes.
And but then you ought to remember the SDP in the 80s. SDP were like that.
Mm.
And they disappeared.
But it's different.
I'm sure it is different, but we need milestones. We need to celebrate the local elections this year. We need to hopefully celebrate the synod elections, regional elections next year. And if we can do well in both of them, we just need to keep plodding forward. I don't think there's no room for complacency at all.
Well, on that note, thank you very much indeed for coming. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I hope everybody else has too.
You're welcome, and I'll happy to come on again.
Well,
that's another point.
Yep. Good. Thanks.
I want my country back, and the country I'm talking about would not tolerate this nonsense.
But now you have a choice. There is a party that will represent you and stand up for common sense.
And when the dam bursts, it will do so spectacularly.
I overturned the biggest ever Conservative majority of 25,500 people.
But if Britain is broken, then logically, Britain needs reform.